Hello, welcome to the Bad Vibes Club. Welcome to episode 5 of this special series I'm doing with Andrea Franchi on sculpture. Well, on texts about sculpture, that's the important thing, really. In this episode, we are looking at Barbara McCullough's film Shopping Bag Spirits and Freeway Fetishes, which we think was from around 1979, 1980. There's a few dates kind of floating around for that film. Barbara McCullough is an artist, and it's a film that she made while she was a graduate student, actually, back in the 70s. And in that film, Barbara McCullough speaks to a number of artists about their relationship to ritual. This actually includes lots of musicians and poets and other people, but we focus on the visual artists she speaks to. And in particular, in this episode, we look at David Hammons, we look at Sengen Engudi, and we look at Betty Saar, who are all really important. Well, they all are still really important figures in Black American art. And this is them at different stages in their career, but, you know, kind of relatively early, before they were embraced by, I guess, kind of museums and larger institutions and were having smaller shows. We also use a text by Linda Goodbryant and Marcy S. Phillips, who edited a book called Contextures, and we read the essay with the same title from that book, in which Linda Goodbryant and Marcy S. Phillips argue for a particular style of art that combines abstraction with a kind of reference or bringing in of social context, hence this idea of contextures. And it's a really useful way to, well, really helpful way to think about the work of the artists in the film as well. So ritual and sculpture is the focus, really, but it's also really helped by this idea of contextures by Linda Goodbryant and Marcy S. Phillips. We discuss David Hammons, we discuss Sengen Engudi, and we discuss Betty Saar. They all have sections in the films, and they're also all in this essay Contextures. Oh, the important thing to say is that they all showed at this gallery in New York called Just Above Midtown, which was run by Goodbryant in the 70s, which showed not just Black artists, but, you know, artists that were outside of the mainstream of the New York scene as well. So again, just to contrast this with the last episode, which is about Rosalind Krauss's Sculpture in the Expanded Field, Contextures actually is getting reappraised as a very important text from around that time as well. There was just a two-part essay on Efflux about Contextures and about how useful it is as a way of understanding a kind of different, slightly different strain of American art. So yeah, obviously we talk about the film, we talk about the essay. Symbolism comes up a lot. We talk about the Contextures essay goes into a distinction between different kinds of found materials, which I found really helpful, between the ready-made, which you may well know from, you know, Marcel Duchamp, etc. But then also they have these other categories, the discard and remains, which we go into. We talk about Sengen Engudi's collaborator and an artist in her own right, Maren Hassinger, and we accidentally called her Martha Hassinger, which is incorrect. We talk about Gatai, the Japanese art movement from the 1950s, which was so influential on so many artists all around the world, including Sengen Engudi. And we talk about Betty Saar's quite nice little idea about ritual as doing what feels right and how that might relate to studio practice. All right, I'll meet you back here at the end. Today we're looking at Shopping Bag Spirits and Freeway Fetishes, which is a film by Barbara McCullough from 90. Is that from 78 or not? No, is that 81? I can't remember the year.
In the film it says 79, but for some reason different places put it between like 78 and 81. I feel like everybody uses a different number. But the film says 79, so let's just use 79.
Okay, cool. So actually, in a way, this is... There's a bit of a link to last time. The last podcast we did was about Rosalind Krauss's Sculpture in the Expanded Field, which is from 79 as well. And this is, I don't know, like it's almost like an alternative or a different look at a different genealogy of artists who are working in the legacy of all the stuff that Krauss was talking about back then, but with a really different angle. So you found this film, so do you want to give it a proper introduction?
Yeah, so I don't remember how I found it, but in my memory, and I couldn't find any of the citations now that I've been looking for them, but there was something about, oh, like Barbara McCullough, which was at film school, did this film. What the citation that I couldn't find said was that she did this film sort of like as a counterpoint of all these different like art theories, which in my head was exactly the October Magazine and Rosalind Krauss people ideas about how art functions. So it's not only a different genealogy, but it's like a very different way of thinking about what sculpture is and what art is and how those processes work. And I loved it. And I was also very confused and I couldn't understand it. And I thought, oh, this is like a perfect thing to do with math then, because then we can understand it together. And I have to say, yesterday night, I saw it for like, I think the fourth time. And yesterday night was the first time that I was like, I finally get it. Because now I know who the artists are. I know the context. I actually managed to like remember everything they said. But just in terms of like students as well, because it's such a different text and way of thinking and presenting information than the other things that we've been doing, that is good to know that, yeah, just because something is a film, it doesn't mean that it's easier, you know what I mean? That written text. It's going to give a bit more of an introduction. So Barbara McCullough was a filmmaker. She was studying at UCLA. So this is a film that she made while she was at a uni. And it starts with a film that she made, which is sort of like a film about ritual itself. And then she kind of joins like a different group of friends and artists around her. So I guess like some people are people that you see, she has like a more distant relation, like Betty Saar, and some people like Sengen Ngudi, which I'm a big fan. She's like really good friends with, and they do a lot of work together, or like David Hammond. So it's like, it's also, they do a genealogy in a sense, but it's a contemporary work, right? So she's a uni, she's in her 20s, and she's like with all these other people in her scene that are most of them also in their 20s, trying to figure out their way of doing things and a language to the thing that they're doing. So in a way, it also felt quite connected to students like that are in the last year of the BA or the MA that are looking around and seeing like, well, there's all these people talking about the way art works, and that has nothing to do with the way we are doing things. Like, how do you develop a language or start having a conversation so that you don't have to take what other people are doing, like fit in that mold, but you can like construct your own mold in sort of like an intuitive way. So I kind of really, I love that of it. It's a very different text from the other texts that we've seen in that way, that it's kind of like collective, trying to make a space and a way of thinking for what's going on at exactly that moment between those people.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good point, actually. It's not really a genealogy when she makes it, but I guess to me now, what it does is offer a different way of thinking about sculpture made in the 70s and how people were approaching that. So yeah, that's a good point, that it's made by a young artist about her contemporaries, right? Although it's really important to note that she speaks to musicians and to poets, and the artists she speaks to work mainly with sculpture, but also with performance, like sculpture that is incorporated into performance, or performance that incorporates objects and costumes and stuff. So it's quite a wide-ranging film, but maybe that's quite important anyway, because I think one of the issues with Krauss's text and what we got to last time is the way it excludes the body and excludes all these other ways of working that were happening around the time that she's writing about, that she kind of ignores or tries to almost like filter out, so that she can have this kind of pure, strong theory of, you know, like whatever it was, marked sites and all of these things. Whereas Barbara McCullough, it's a much more free-ranging exercise. And essentially, she just asks different practitioners what their relationship with ritual is, because she notes that she has started kind of thinking about her work in terms of ritual. That's basically it, right? That's the drive of the film. And it's just a series of interviews, but also, you know, she captures performances by the poets and the musicians, improvisations, and plays footage of other people's performances. And I don't know what else is in the, you know, what else should we say about the actual content of the film?
I think that the form of the film is really interesting. There's lots of like weird effects, which I guess in like 79 were like really, and now they're a bit weird, but like the visual of the film is quite experimental. So she, yeah. And that comes from like the course that she was doing. So there's like a scene of like experimental film that this documentary is part of, which is also really interesting, that it's not just like talking heads and things like that. There's like a whole, yeah, visual vibe that is happening with lots of like effects and things like that.
Yeah, the only section where it goes like quite formal is when she interviews Betty, what's the
surname
of that art? Betty Saar.
Yeah.
And they're like in a film studio, and it's really like, she's obviously just really pleased to meet someone who's presumably a higher, you know, at a different stage of their career. I don't know these artists well enough to know that, but that's what I got from the vibe, because she's just like really excited to like ask her questions and like present her ideas and stuff.
Yeah, there's a moment when she's also like sharing her own thinking, right? She's like really happy to articulate what she's doing.
Yeah, Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it's a really nice film. I mean, the quality of the online version is like extremely low, but I guess that's the nature of like ripping VHS. Probably it was ripped to DVD or something and then got put online. I don't really know.
Yeah,
I think you got a better version of it.
I've never seen a better version of it, so it might exist, but it might just be, you know, again, it's like someone who's doing their film at uni. So you use the equipment that you have and you just like make do. So it also has that vibe of, yeah, you do, which I think is the vibe of the scene as well, right? Like it's about like using whatever is at hand and not trying to like dress it up or anything else in a sense.
So how do we want to structure this? Do we want to just go through the film or do you want to talk, are we going to specifically focus on the sculptors or the, you know, visual artists?
Because I rewatched it yesterday, I just made a list as I was watching it of like notes about, yeah, things that I saw was interesting that were coming up in the thinking. So maybe we can just go through the film, but then we're probably going to stop more in the two artists that we are more into. Yeah. Just naturally.
Yeah, there's a few artists that just really popped out. And to be honest as well, some of the artists in the film are just a little bit, maybe their careers went in different directions of stuff. For example, one of the artists I know is now a curator and stuff. So they are, there's not loads and loads of writing about their art practice online, for example. So yeah, why don't you just, yeah, go through your notes and then I'll jump in with stuff as well.
Yeah, so we start with Barbara McCullough film, which I don't know if there's much to talk about. It's like a film of a ritual in an urban space and there's a performance that is not her. And it kind of finished with a scene of a urination. So it says this woman, like, which was really funny because I was going to show the film at Chelsea, and this is not a massive screen, and I completely forgot about that. And obviously, when I put it in a random place, it was just that. But then we go to David Hammond, we were talking today, which is an artist that, again, is a bit like Richard Morris, like I knew, but I didn't really know.
Robert Morris.
Yeah, Robert Morris.
You love calling him Richard Morris. No, it's fine.
And I just think he's like, yeah, it's a really amazing scene. So he's in this kind of like abandoned space. And at the moment he's working in LA and he's like showing this kind of sculpture that he's building just by like putting things together.
And he's it's like literally rubble and detritus, right? And he's just moving it around. And in fact, that's how he describes it. He's like very clear that he's not creating or producing any of the material that he's using.
Yeah, and he talks a lot about energy, which is something that comes up a lot by others artists talking about ritual, but then other contextualizations of this sort of work. So this idea of like that he's putting energy in things. So sometimes he puts something there and he leaves it in a while and he takes it away. And he says that like transports the energy, which I thought was really interesting. And he said he has just this amazing, I mean, he's so young, but he has this like, amazing, I think like wise, calm way of thinking about what he's doing. So there's a bit where he says the most value is that it was worth doing. And he's always like talking about process in that way. And then he's comparing these two sculptures. And one of them, he says, this design has started to accept, which I thought was such a nice way to say it. And the other one is still kind of chaotic. And then he starts saying that the one that has started to accept will be accepted at a gallery, will be accepted as an artwork because it has a certain order. And then he frames it as, it shows labor, like the difference between the sculptures is that one of them shows labor and people respect labor. And it has like order, balance and focal points. And those things show labor and people respect labor as being something that constructs art. Well, he actually, he really likes the other sculpture, but the other sculpture wouldn't be able to be read as art by other people. And I thought it was like a really interesting way to distinguish like this transformation. I kept thinking about I know I complain about it, but I keep thinking about crafts and this idea of like not landscape and not architecture.
Yeah, and it's slipping too much to one side of being landscape or whatever. Yeah, or being, you know, architecture. I completely agree. I love that bit. I thought there's something really important about, the ambiguity, the way he kind of slips back and forth, because actually that quote you said, the quote about putting things on and leaving them there. So he says, put things on things and leave them and take them off after the energy has been put in them. And then he kind of looks at camera and he says, I mean, that's only true because someone says it is. So he has this relationship to this notion of energy, which is not quite ironic, but slightly ambivalent in the sense that he's interested in energy, but he's also not quite sure if he believes that, you know, like it does do this transferring. And then again, this notion that at first he says that he started to accept this sculpture that he's made, and then he switches and turns to the other sculpture, which he doesn't need to accept because it's totally uncontrived. And I can't remember what else he says about that sculpture, but it wouldn't be accepted by a gallery, but he prefers it. But that's also a problem, you know, and he kind of slips back and forth between like what the art object should be. Like, should it be indistinguishable from its surroundings, or does it require like, yes, what? Yeah, the stuff you said, like balance, focal points, centre of interest. But also that labour thing I picked up on as well, because that reminded me of Felida Barlow talking about the values of mid-century sculpture in Britain, which were all about, I can't remember the phrase she uses, but essentially, yeah, how much work you put into, how much graft you put into like making the sculpture. And he's almost like joking about like how silly that is, that anyone would think about art in that way. But yeah, he's also being really clear that he understands that the market does think about art in that way. And also, like, you know, David Hammond's, out of all of these artists, ends up being the most successful commercial artist, I think. Is that true to say?
Yeah, and it's amazing because he's such an interesting artist. So he has this career where he kind of like is constantly walking away of things. So like things start making too much success, he walks away, or he does things like, I was reading, we're going to talk about, you know, secondary text that we refer to this called Contextures by Linda Wood Brian, who used to run, and another curator, I don't remember the name, but she used to run just above Midtown, which is this big New York gallery that is kind of like launch these people's, you know, him and Ngundi careers. And she was saying that, you know, he would do a show and he'll put certain things in the ceiling or things like that. And he wouldn't allow her to like write it or make it visible. It would be like, if people notice it, then they notice. And then if not, they're not. But then I was reading, we can link for it, but there's like a essay in The New Yorker today. And they were saying that, you know, in the, I don't know, late 90s or early 2000s, when Jeff Koons and I forgot the other artists, but start like getting like massive prices, Gerald Richter in the art market, Hammond starts thinking that this is like is an important point to have a black artist that is at that level. So he starts openly, he has all these strategies to play with the market. So he actually kind of like intellectually kind of finds a way to up his prices and like can produce ways and circulate in ways because he thinks it's politically important to occupy that space. So he has
I didn't know that.
He has this, and I just read it like 10 minutes ago, so I didn't know about it either. But he does these things like, you know, if a gallery wants to show his work, then they have to buy the whole work at specific prices. And it goes back to the ambiguity. He calls it fantasy prices because, you know, you have to like imagine this before this comes into being. And then the gallery has to keep the objects for like at least a year before they do a show and before they can sell it. So he starts making all these different structures after not having make money with his work for like decades as part of his art practice, which is super, super. He's really interesting in many different ways.
So that's really interesting to hear, because the reason I already knew David Hammond's work, but I kind of met it in the late 90s, early 2000s, and had been really like, at that point, I was really finding myself like growing up in the UK in the 90s, it was all about like Damien Hirst and all of that lot. And they did lots of like terrible puns that would be about kind of literalizing metaphors or idioms. And David Hammond in the late 90s and early 2000s, he does a lot of that. I mean, now I'm looking at that work and I'm finding it more interesting. But at the time, I didn't have the context to distinguish between that stuff and the stuff of like YBAs. That's the phrase, isn't it? It slipped my mind for a second, the YBAs. So yeah, like coming back to it now, it's like, yeah, so clear that it's really different. But that makes a lot of sense that, yeah, perhaps he entered the market in a big way at that point, and maybe that's the context that I've kind of first encountered him. And I was just like becoming a bit more like clued up as to the relationship that I had to artists who were getting big prices or whatever. I don't know. But yeah, man, he's so good. And that, and like, it's really hard to explain, but like the sculptures are just really good.
They're amazing.
Like in that empty lot. They're just really good. And it's like hard to like think, like fathom, like, oh yeah, he's just like, he is really just like messing around. Oh, actually, that's what I wanted to say about this whole film. And actually lots of the artists, the way they talk about their work in the film, they talk about it in, we've been talking about, okay, there's a relationship between the artist and the object. And then we've been talking about the relationship between the object, well, the artwork and the viewer, and the artwork and the space, all these different relationships. This film, I would say, is very focused on the relationship between artist and artwork. And I wonder if this comes from this idea of ritual and energy, which is maybe something more about the ineffable, you know, kind of qualities of working with materials and stuff like that. And maybe it kind of, I don't know, yeah, it just seemed really interesting because we've been having that conversation over a few podcasts. Anyway, and the relationship between David Hammons and those, you know, bits of stone and wood and cement that he's moving around. It's so clear that he's like having a really intimate relationship with them over the time that he spends in that empty lot.
Yeah, I think relation is the thing, is one of the things that came in like almost all of them, all of the definitions of ritual. So it was like on the conversation with four poets was my only note, but they say ritual establishes and reaffirms the relations. And I think that comes over and over. And I think to me, that's the interesting thing, because that's a way of thinking about art that feels so much closer to my understanding of art than Rosalind Krauss. And, you know, Senga Ngudi, there's a lot of writing because her work is performed always by Martha Hassinger, which is also an artist, but is also like this friend. And there's this, you know, the performances are always done by friends. Like these people are just like popping into each other's art wars all the time. And then they talk about the ritual also as like, you know, making a point of these relations to the past. So it is this kind of relation and intuition and affection with the artwork and the material, but also with the people that you're making work with the viewer, with your ancestor or with genealogy, like all this affective, I don't know if affective is the right way, but all this, intimate relations or like this closeness becomes like so central to the way of not only making the work, but also justifying like the choice to like put that forefront, because it's not like Robert Morris, I got it right this time, Robert Morris, you know, and minimalism cannot be thought in terms of like the relations with Donald Judd and Yvonne Rainer and Simone Forti and the dancing, like all those relations are there. But in a way, when you kind of like intellectualize the work, you kind of erase that. It took me a long time to find those relations because the work becomes this other thing that is like autonomous. And I think in the works that are in this film, one of the things that the whole idea of the ritual bring to fore is this idea of collectivity, the collectivity with, you know, with things, with the past, with objects, with each other, with materials. Those are the things that make the artwork.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, that quote is Kay Curtis Lyle, who's a poet, and I don't know. And yeah, again, just to extend it a bit, seems like we're talking about people, places, and things. Well, ritual establishes relationships between people, places, and things. And that's they're all the relationships we'll be talking about, right? So like people, the artists, or the audience, places, you know, where the space where it's shown, and things, the artworks. So yeah, he gets to the heart of it, I think. And to think about, I think maybe what I was really interested in is, especially in the essay, the Contextures essay, was about the symbolic qualities and materials, which I think in other readings of Black artists or Black American artists' work from this time and later is really foregrounded. And the, I guess, like formal and, yeah, like the relationship to abstraction and post-minimalism or minimalism is backgrounded. Does that make sense? And in that Contextures essay, what she does is she works really hard to make it clear, like, they are working with modes of abstraction and symbolism. And that made me think about, that made me kind of reassess, like, yeah, like you say, like Robert Morris's work, and thinking, well, there's symbolism there too. It's just not foregrounded in the interpretation. Yeah, so like it did that thing that Tina Post is kind of trying to do in that other essay we looked at last time, where she hasn't quite managed to do it, but like she's trying to say like all of these, well, these three Black artists she was looking at were working with this minimal approach, but they were interpreted as essentially being about Black experience in America. And I think David Hammons is the kind of obvious example of that, where he's, I mean, some of those works, like the hair works, where he like, I can't actually find any other pictures, but there's a work from the mid-70s just called Untitled, and it's these pyramids of hair, presumably his own hair, but maybe other people's.
I have them here.
So you know.
We can
upload. Oh, you've got the actual book.
No, I got the Senga Ngudi book, and there's a photo of it, of that work.
Oh, no way. Yeah. Scan it. That would be great. Because the picture I can see, the uploaded PDF is like really blurry and I just can't find it anywhere else. But like you say, Hammons in at that point was kind of discarding work and moving on very quickly and stuff. So, you know, it's not necessarily archived. But the point being there is that it's really, really, it really is a formal minimalist artwork about, you know, like these pyramid shapes being made out of unconventional materials, just like, yeah, Robert Smithson's mirrored boxes or something. It's just that the materials he's working with are symbolically, are much more obviously symbolically loaded to both white and black audiences, I think.
But I think it's also like, it's funny, like I find the word symbolic slightly, I don't want to say problematic, but maybe like not precise, because symbolic is already, to me, it feels already like coming from this other way of thinking work. And I think there's something about, and this is something that I couldn't understand properly in contextures. I think I read that a few times, and I find it, there's something that doesn't necessarily click in my brain yet about the way she distinguishes the ready-made. So the move of like moving this material, this object that have a history and kind of like really letting go of it. And then this other move that these artists are doing that kind of like works with that context, or like the idea of the, these objects become remains of these
remains,
other objects
that's the word.
In the world.
Yeah, super interesting.
But there's this really cool, so this is from the New Yorker's essay that I just read like a few minutes ago, but it has a bit that says, and it has like a lot of quotes from Hammonds. He believed there was spiritual energy in everyday elements of Black street culture, begin quote. I was actually going insane working with hair. That's how potent it is. With the wine bottles, a Black person's lip have touched each and every one, so you have to be very careful, end quote. Hammonds has thought of Robert Farris Thompson, the Yale historian of African art and culture, whose 1983 book Flash of the Spirit dealt with the art, music, and architecture of six African civilizations, Yoruba, Congo, Ejawam, Ewe, Fon, and Mande, begin quote. You have to go back to what we were before you, before you go forward to what we want to be, finish quote. Hammond has said to Thompson, as Thompson's recall in a 92 essay, begin quote again, I be into memory more than the avant-garde, end quote. And I think, sorry, like those like quotes got to cover quite a few things that I thought were interesting about him. But the thing about, you know, this, yeah, that is not only hair, right? It's black hair, and there's like a specific energy, and it's connected to the body, and it's human, and that comes through. And that you have to treat this as part of people that still they have this kind of intimate connection. So it's not only symbolism, right? Something else there that maybe it's covering the ritual thing, but it's not only that, you know, the black hair is a symbol of like identity and the role of black hair in, you know, the politics of black culture in America. There's something about, yeah, like the body and the love and the connections and the care for, yeah, this thing, you know, that maybe represent a certain level of mistreatment or like violence, or there's all these other things come together that I think neither, you know, the symbolic or the psychoanalytic cover, they're doing something else. And that's what I watched this film many, many times still, because I think it's kind of like pointing to a different way of reading work that is,
yeah,
it's its own universe.
Yeah, I mean, ritual, I think, you know, I mean, just to finish off that idea about the symbolic, yeah, I think what symbolic refers to is the way it's intimately tied to discourse and culture and like bigger ideas, essentially, that are based in language. And but to be honest, like, materiality should include the symbolic, right? If what you're saying is the symbolic is too reductive a phrase, then the issue isn't with the symbolic, but with the notion of materiality, which is so present in minimalist and post-minimalist artworks. We're just not noting the symbolic qualities of working with mirrored glass or fluorescent lights. But of course, like, they are, like, fluorescent light being exactly coextensive with, like, you know, modern or 20th century office work or something. I've just been working under LED lights all day and my eyes flickered when I left the building, right? So that's like a very specific, I don't know, does that make sense? Like, we often try and separate these things out, but I think maybe the whole point, the whole interesting comparison between this film and Krauss's text last time we met and spoke is that the symbolic and ritual should be reinserted into, you know, histories of minimalism and post-minimalist sculpture, because it's all there, it's just not foregrounded, because the artists being spoken about are mainly white, essentially, like, and, you know, to like reduce it to that kind of the racial dynamics of art history or something.
But I think it's also about, you know, it's also about the different, you know, how people, I don't know, identify or prefer certain types of theory again. And it's like, I think for a certain type of strong theory, then you have to like just get rid of so much stuff. But
yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that I love about getting really into the Robert Morris thing is like how much Robert Morris talked about, you know, how minimalism comes from Simon Forti and Yvonne Rainer, and, you know, and how those materials, you know, he first built them from Simon Forti to do like the stage thing. So even like, you know, his materials have history. Like he literally uses the same boards that he uses to do the weird corridor in Yoko Ono's flat. And again, you know, you're starting to have, you know, these relations and these people and these spaces, and then he kind of cuts them down and use them to build those sculptures. So in a sense, like those in this, I what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that I think the way of thinking and making that Hammonds and Ngudi use in their work are the same ways of working that exist in Mori's work.
Oh, no, I completely agree. Yeah, yeah.
But exactly. I just think like for someone like Krauss or from a certain type of art history that's interested in certain readings, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm trying to say, but you're just putting it in better words.
No, I think it's just because in a way, what I don't want is I wouldn't want this way of like thinking or writing or describing to just be co-opted, you know, and then you can make the Rosalind Krauss things work. I sort of like them where they are. Yeah, I think that's the thing, because I think they have to be specific, and they have to be weak, and they have to be, you know, like muddy and uncertain and inconclusive. And that's the way that I think art history should be thought. And it's not that we need to make strong theory better, so it kind of finally encompasses all these things. It's almost like, but I think that's also like about my relation with theory.
And also, I think it's what's really different about this as a text is that you have artists speaking directly about their work, but they're also being asked a very specific question. So they're all speaking about ritual and energy, but they've been asked about ritual and energy. So they're definitely all happy to speak about their work in those terms, but they're also, you know, they're answering a question which is about, how does ritual feature in your work, or what's your relationship to ritual? So they all answer in those terms. So they may well foreground it in their own work, or it might just be, you know, like a part of a wider.
I think it's also like, again, like they all work together, like, you know, Sengen and Ngudi and David Hammond share a studio, and, you know, David Hammond's perform on, you know, the performance that is talked in the video, and they're like besties forever. And McCullough photographs all the Ngudi things. So as far as I know, all those people are just, you know, they're just this group of friends. And then I think Betty Saar is like their idol. So there's like a clear difference of like, but I think it also happens, right? That you have this group of friends and you realize, oh, we're all sort of like doing, which again, the same thing happened with the minimalists and stuff, right? It's like, oh, we're all sort of doing the same thing. And then you end up talking about these things. But I don't think, you know, I don't think she has pushed those artists to think about their work through ritual, but I think they're sort of friends because they all kind of like share this way of thinking about their work.
Yeah, what's your next point? Because I've got other stuff to say about that, but maybe we can get through a bit more. Because
I think my notes after that, the ones that are things that we haven't talked about, will be about Senga Nengudi. Yeah, she's another artist that I just fall in love in the last year, and the more I read and I look about her work, I just think she's like extraordinary. And her film is not really a film. So Barbara McCullough was supposed to film, I think even before she was going to do this documentary, as a friend, she was going to film the performance, and the equipment failed and they lost the film. So there's no film of this performance. There's only photographs.
This is the Freeway Fete, right? Is that the...
Yes. Yeah. So she got a commission to do this sculpture. So it's like, I don't know how you describe that in English. But it's like under a freeway. So she made this.
I mean, we call it an underpass, which is such an unromantic thing. But yeah.
Yeah. So an underpass. So she does this sculpture in one of the pillars using, how do you call this material that she used? Tights?
Yeah, she used tights, nylon tights.
And then she decides to do like a performance to kind of like, I don't know, what would be the word? Like to open it to the world, or like to and she get David Hammonds to perform, and she gets Martha Hassingway. I already forgot, sorry, I have a list with all the names, so I don't.
Oh yeah, I couldn't work out that name. So is that someone who performs in her work every time? Is that what you were saying?
Yes, since then till now. So even now, when her work is shown in the museum, she's the one who performs it.
And what is her name? Sorry, I just wanted to...
Martha Hassinger.
Okay, cool. And is she an artist in her own right, or
she does sculpture. Cool. Actually, she was quite more successful than Ngudi for quite a while.
Oh, Maren Hassinger, sorry,
I said it wrong.
Cool.
I cannot read my own handwriting. And she was also part of the studio, so this Studio Z with David Hammonds. So they do this performance. So she does all the outfits as part of her sculpture, and she performs, and she kind of like has this idea that Hammond's going to be male energy and Hassinger is going to be the female energy. And she's kind of like doing this bridge, and they do this whole ritual and event. So that's a thing that is shown in photographs in the film. And then there's also a lot of photographs of her nylon tight sculptures, which are absolutely, they're just so incredible. And she uses like sand to stretch them. And there's a lot of like her writing at the time, which is really interesting. So she had two kids and she was interested in this idea of the skin of the woman who like stretches and go back to normal, but also not 100% to what it was. So she's kind of like interested in bodies. And also this idea that, you know, she'll go to a place with like a small bag of tights. Some of them are used by friends, again, like this connection. Some of them are new, and kind of like build this sculptures in place, and then she can just put it in the back. She's quite interested in permanence. She major arts, fine arts and dance. So this is all like also like is a scene of like recent graduates in a sense. All of them have this kind of like art school experience in different levels. But I think for her, she's always this, she's just existing to the space between being a dancer and being a sculptor. And she has also this other thing that I think in terms of genealogy is super interesting, which is goes to Japan on a scholarship for a year, and she's really into Gutai. Mm. So she's looking at a lot of like Japanese art, but also, and also like Japanese dance and theater. And she's also, so the catalog that I have is for a show in Brazil. And in the catalog, she's talking about seeing the work of Lydia Clark in the late 60s, which are these kind of like bags of air with like stones for you to touch. And this idea of like, you know, again, go back to the first episode, this art that can be touched, that can be, I hate the word interacted, but like, I think touch is better, that can, yeah, that have this kind of different relation to the viewer than is not distant. And the idea of her sculptures was that people could touch and move them. And she talks about like changing her mind a lot. You know, people start touching the sculptures and she's like, oh, I don't think I like this. Actually. And I guess the last thing is like her sculptures, a lot of them are seen as part of performance, but they're seen in photographs. So the sculptures were not performed live at the time. She would like make them into space, and then Hassinger will like interact with them and took photographs, and the photographs are amazing. But then I think since the 2000, when there has been like a resurgence, now when she shows the work, you know, Hassinger goes there and performs, which is also really cool, no because way. In the photo she's like super young, and now it's a very different relation. But it made me think about this idea of like, I really love this idea of like how art objects live through history. So, you know, the Duchamp ready-made being like remade, or like Maurice having this retrospective at the Tate and saying like, well, but minimalist sculptures are now a playground. They're not you know, these things. And again, like this reinscription of her work in the contemporary where these objects are like, yeah, being activated in the museum in a different way in front of people well before. It's kind of cool to do these sculptures that only fully are completely fulfilled through photographs. In a sense, you can never access the whole story. Sorry, that was a long thing. I just been reading on her for the past 2 weeks. I just really I think she's extraordinary.
No, I think it's really important to kind of make, and you know, we've been talking about the relationship between performance and sculpture, and I think her work is so, because the sculptures, even when they're installed as sculptures, they look very similar to the sculptures that are used as kind of performance props in these amazing photos, which sometimes look like almost like the way Bauhaus, no, is it Bauhaus? Or Black Mountain College, like performances were photographed, these kind of black and white, very like rigid photographs of dancers in poses rather than necessarily moving. But then the, it's got this very particular use of nylon tights, which she talks about the relationship to bodies and flexibility. And I suppose just to bring it back to this notion of like symbolism or another word, I mean, the whole point of contextures, right, which is that essay, is that I don't know if they're trying to coin a movement or if they thought of themselves as a movement, or sorry, if the writer's trying to coin a movement or if they thought of themselves as a movement. But she says that the artists involved in this movement, after determining and clarifying the inherent properties of art, so that's the kind of like these guys are related to abstract art bit, they go outside its margin in order to incorporate it within the context of external phenomena. So she's making a real claim for like, this is abstract art that has a relationship to like the world that it's in. It's through this process of clarifying and incorporating the contents of the margin that they define the context, meaning and relationship between art and reality. This writer is trying to do this quite specific thing of like retaining the abstract formal qualities of their work and also being able to talk about the political content. And you know, the quote she has from Senga Nengudi that you referred to is like quite extreme, right? It's like the body can only stand so much push and pull until it gives way. And then later, I thought of black work nurses suckling child after child, their own as well as those of others, until their breasts rested upon their knees, their energy drained. And she's not saying literally that that's what she is making. She's not making like figurative sculpture or anything. But yeah, like when you think about it in those terms, it is very bodily and quite visceral. And there's a kind of formal politics to it, if that makes sense. Like it is referring to a very specific violent history. So I think like symbolic is, yeah, maybe that's not a very good word. But yeah, there is a difference between, to go back to Hammond's, like, you know, using his own hair or using nylon, in Senga Nengudi's, using nylon tights versus using like, whatever, steel beams or, I don't know, like think of other kind of like materials that are used. Or even just, you know, in using kind of cut fabric or something that happens in minimalist and post-minimalist work. And I suppose it is this ritual thing that connects it, because that does connect it back to the body. So yeah, I suppose that, yeah, it's been a really useful set of texts to look at, to think about lots of different work and how it connects to the body and to performance and to a kind of wider politics or something.
And I think what the difference of the contextures is doing between like what Duchamp is doing and what, you know, Hammond's and Nengudi and their examples are doing, it kind of like, to me, it gets clearer once we kind of like accept this idea of energy. So what she's saying in a sense is like, you know, you get the urinal and you put the urine in the gallery and it's still a urinal, but in a sense that object was always sort of already kind of like a dead object in a sense. It was like this thing. Well, if you think about the energy, you know, of these tights that are from like Nengudi's friends, or like the hair that are from like black people that David Hammond feel this kind of like personal connection with, like those objects, they bring that energy with them, even though, you know, you're taking them from the world and you put it into the gallery. They're not neutral. They have this connection. But I think, yeah, like I think it's something more about the symbolic connection. There's like literally a level of energy or connection because they have touched these other people. And that's where you, and the fact that they're not being cleaned out of that.
But I think really key, and the quote again, I'll just read it because it is a good one. She says, remains constitute the matter or substance left over from a primary action. So you've already got something there related to like a like body doing something, right? So that's key. And then she says, unlike a discard, which is, so she has ready-made discards and remains. Unlike a discard, which had a function or purpose that ceased to perform, or a ready-made, which has an intended purpose and function, which it still performs. Yeah, so that's Duchamp's urinal. The remain has no particular purpose or function or a definition clarifying its intent. So it's not like lost a function. It's not got a kind of inherent meaning or something. It's just really charged with the fact that it's left over from some kind of activity that's happened. So I guess the point is that it brings to mind some activity, but is not, you know, if you think about hair, it's not the scissors that have cut the hair. It's the, you know, hair that has been cut off. Whereas if you use scissors in a work, it'd be like a ready-made, right? So you could refer to hairdressing or refer to cutting, because those are the actions that we all know that scissors do. But with hair, yeah, you could bring to mind the hairdresser, but you can also bring to mind, and she talks about this is where I get really interested in it, because this is stuff I'm interested in my own work. She doesn't talk about disgust, actually. What does she say? Oh, repelling. Yeah, the you know, because Hammond's also uses barbecue rib bones, other kind of detrite, you know, like, well, remains, yeah. She talks about repelling the viewer, but also intriguing the viewer. So kind of pushing and pulling the viewer. And then she also, to think back to Tina Post's idea of threat, or this kind of Michael Fried's like being almost kind of having a really bad vibe from minimalism. She uses the word taunts in relation to David Hammond's work. It taunts the viewer, and also it includes and excludes participation. So yeah, to think about this notion of like inviting touch, but also repelling, and also the artist having a kind of ambiguous idea about like whether they want people to touch it, or, you know, how they think about it as an art object. So I think that's really nice that
the text kind of retains this relationship between these, well, I don't want to say dualities, it's a horrible word, but these opposing feelings or something.
And then Nguru has a really nice definition of ritual, or like not definition, but when she talks about ritual, she says ritual can be like a ceremoniously way of doing something, a form of doing something that people have done many times before you, which I saw was, again, like a different type of like way of thinking of genealogy or something. And again, like you're using these tides that, you know, that other women use all the time, that you have like this material that have this, yeah, this history of this action. And then you're just like doing this action in a different space or something. But I think that was something that was very surprising to me. When I think about ritual, part of me, you know, just think about the fetishization of like certain like spiritual experiences in a sense. Like to me, ritual is such a charged word in the art world. It comes with a lot of things that I, like it's trying to do a lot of work. When you call, when an artist say they're doing ritual, you're like, oh my God, they're using that word to like, you know, make these large claims and say that their work is like doing all this stuff. And the way people talk about ritual in this video is so everyday. It's just these
go on, finish that thought and then I've got something to say about that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking about, you know, when Sarah is talking about ritual, she talks about, oh, ritual is what feels right. You've done something and it feels right. And, you know, something happened afterwards and then you kind of like keep repeating it. And it's like this ritual is the repeating of what feels right. And all these things feel so connected to our daily practice of living and intuition and the choices that we make in everyday life. So it doesn't have this, it is a spiritual in the sense of the I'm going to put this here and the energy is going to pass in an everyday way of making sculpture. But it's not ritual in necessarily a way of like making spirituality or this process something like higher that are like... Yeah. Special that only special people do in special settings or something. I think that's what I'm trying to say. Sorry, I didn't think about this properly before saying it.
No, that's super interesting because I think that is it. That there's what I really appreciate is basically right. Minimalism, or the legacy of one of the legacies of minimalism, is about not using art materials, right? So no longer using whatever bronze or clay or whatever, but using other materials that might be from other realms of work or other practices and stuff. So how do you choose those materials, right? Because you don't have any relationship to steel or to glass or to human hair artistically until you do. And I think, yeah, the Betty Saar idea that what feels right, getting certain outcomes from doing something and that then being kind of repeated over and over again is kind of the way, you know, that's the way that I've found materials, is like suddenly getting, I don't know, you know, to use the language that they used in the film, is like, yeah, suddenly getting some energy from something, to actually energy, like literally of like an impetus to go to the studio and start working with hair, which I've worked with before, or food materials, which I've worked with before. And then I suppose I've got a quote, well, not quite, something I wrote down here. Ritual to many of these artists is about some kind of slightly higher affect level between artist and material, which then drives the work, which might end up as a very charged work or not. Like, it doesn't have to end up as like, yeah, like a really charged performance or something. It can end as, you know, Betty Saar and David Hammond's and Senga Nengudi's work does, as like quite a quiet like art object that sits well in a white walled gallery space, you know, like going back to this kind of cool low affect aesthetic of post, when I say post minimal, I don't mean like, I mean literally like after minimalism, what does art kind of look like? Then moving on, I really like that idea of ritual, and I really like the way it connects to studio practice, but also to, yeah, like you say, like everyday practices of like, you know, you like a restaurant, so you go back to the same restaurant over and over again, and you form a connection to that place and to the people and the space, and then you move cities or something, and you kind of, that remains as, you know, all of this stuff that like is probably where, you know, think about it in those big terms, is a form of kind of secular religiosity or whatever. But I think probably because of the time it's made, like, actually there is a lot of like what I would think of as like dodgy talk, which is of like, yeah, like male and female energy, and like the poets are like referring quite a lot to like Rastafarianism, but then also to Islam and stuff, and it's like, oh yeah, like sub, I guess like it's the vibe of the 70s is people are reaching around and trying to find like spiritual practices to kind of lock into that feel right for them, but without considering really that these things maybe have, I don't know, they have like specific meanings to like the cultures that have practiced them for longer or something. You know, that some of the energy stuff I'm like not into, essentially. I can't remember where I've got it. Male and female energy, like not into that. Like not because of some particular view on gender, but just the notion of like, I'm much more interested when people, the artists are talking about the materials than I am when anyone's talking about like universal negative or positive energy, blah, blah, blah. Like that's the universalist I've got here. Okay, the bits I don't like is all the universalist shit, because that feels like a you know, a kind of retrograde step in terms of how they're speaking about their work or something.
Yeah, I think to me the most interesting ways of talking about energy is when, you know, when Hammond is talking about you put something there and then you take it out and then you put it there, or like, you know, this idea that while you're using this material that has, you know, been in contact with people, and then something, they have this kind of like affective connections to, so some of that remains in the material. I think, yeah, like those, like, again, like every, I don't know how to say this, like very specific.
Yeah.
Specific relations are always more interesting than the colloquial universal. But I thought that when I heard like Saar talking about that, you know, the ritual as you do what feels right and then you repeat it, to me that was like, that section, I feel like every art student should hear that, because that's like the best description of an art practice that I have ever heard, is that what you learn at art school is just to learn to listen to that, because we're trained to ignore it because you have to follow, you know, what the world demands of you that is right. And the process of going to art school, in a sense, is like redeveloping that intuition of like, oh, how do I do all these things to find out what feels right? And then how do I recognize when something feels right? And how can I learn it to repeat it? And that it doesn't matter that what feels right might be, I don't know, doing YouTube films or cooking or painting with like red paint, or it might be, you know, that it can be whatever, but it's like this, it takes a long time to listen, to learn to that internal voice that says something feels right, or to try to put something there and pay attention to what happens and then take it out. Like,
I think the key there, and I think that's really, really true. And Betty Saar, it's really nice, because she does a little etymology, right? She says ritual, the root word is a rite, as in R-I-T-E, but then she just switches it and says, but you know, it makes me think of right, R-I-G-H-T. Getting certain outcomes, right outcomes from doing something. So when I make art, it feels right. I know it's the right way to do it. But the key with ritual, right, is that you go back and you practice it again. And sometimes it doesn't feel right, but you do it anyway because it's your ritual now. That's the key about ritual, is that you come back and do it again. And I think, you know, I was doing it today. I'm like doing this digital drawing. It took a whole day to do, barely any work. It doesn't look very good at the moment because it's only like, I was just saying, it's like a 16th finished. It's like, I'm not quite sure why I'm doing it or whether the outcome's right. But I did get that energy when I first started it. And now I go back and do it over and over again. And, I say this all the time because I really like it. But, you know, I left the studio feeling kind of ashamed and weird about what I'd done all day, because it's like really hard work, but also like no one asked me to do it. And when I leave the studio sometimes, I find it very hard to like look at people in the street in the eye, because I haven't seen anyone all day and haven't spoke to anyone all day. But also I think because, yeah, you've just been doing this like thing that you're essentially unsure of, but you're like keeping hold of that original energy of when it did feel right and being like, no, I'm going to go back and do that again. So I think it's important to note that like you're not following your like desire of what you want to do at any given moment. You're following a very specific moment of energy that you found when you, I don't know, engage with a certain material or with a certain way of working, or
yeah, and the relation of that between that and the project, right? Because I think the project is such a trap, especially when in art school, and you think you have to come up with a framework and then that will be your right, and then you just like work to fulfill it. And it's such a different mode to, again, to learn to listen to those things and to, I don't even know how to explain it, to like believe the repetition there, you know, to have that moment again, to like find the energy and then just like trust the repetition, but at the same time be in tune with the repetition, so you know when you need to change it or you need to break it. It's like a whole new set of like attentions that you have to develop that are really hard. They're really hard. I think art school is really hard.
I think attention is really important, because I think maybe that's a more contemporary word. We all think about attention a lot because of the attention economy, social media, and the way attention seems to be talked about as a resource or as a kind of like what's the word when something gets used up? Like, anyway, yeah. And, you know, you can't, you know, it's almost talked about as like something you expend and then you can't get it back, you know, like money or time or something. And I think like what you pay attention to is really key. And I suppose like when you're talking about ritual, about energy, all of these things that get talked about a lot in these in the film and in the essay, yeah, you are talking about like paying attention to what you're paying attention to, right? This kind of meta level of attention, of noticing what you notice and following that. And then that gets us to, you know, we've been mentioning various kind of aesthetic categories connected to different affective states, and interest is very much like theorized by Sean Nye about conceptual and post-conceptual practices. It's a very cool affect. It's a very minimal affect. Interest is often the beginning of a bigger affect, which might be excitement or enthusiasm or love or disgust or hate or anything. It's like the affect that comes before affect or whatever, you know, the feeling that comes before a bigger emotion. And getting in tune with, like, you know, your interest is actually quite hard to do, because often we're asked by whatever, capitalism or the attention economy, to only notice things when we are like entertained by them or angered by them, like attain some kind of higher level of emotion. And that also, I think, leads a lot of project-based artwork, which is, I'm going to engage with this big idea that you can understand, and then I need to somehow make something that's as big as that big idea. But a lot of the best, a lot of my favorite artwork is kind of minor, or like engages with minor ideas. And that's probably because it comes from, yeah, like a connection to a smaller thing rather than a bigger abstraction or a bigger political meaning, which maybe why the idea of symbolism is hard to swallow a bit, because that does tend to be an attempt by people interpreting work to bring the work in line with big, you know, political or social forces that maybe art isn't often, you know, the best way to engage with those things. And have you got any other final kind of final notes?
Well, I think one thing that we just like mentioned but didn't talk about is this kind of relation between like Ngudi and Gutai or Ligia Clark, which is something that didn't come in like Rosalind Krauss as well.
I forgot to say, can you maybe just frame, like, what is Gutai, just to for the listeners?
There's like this movement in Japan in the 50s that is interested in like the body and materials, and is doing lots of things in like public spaces and impermanence. And it's something that kind of comes up every now and then because it's so radical and ahead of its time. And it kind of like, it's one of those things, again, that when you kind of like construct these genealogies that only allow for the US and for Europe, it kind of like gets forgotten. But, and he's also like come up while reading by like different, like it's influenced like in Brazil, or it's influenced in, for example, I was reading the other day, Jade Montserrat was talking about her work. So she's like a contemporary Black British artist, and she was talking about Gutai. So I was just like interested in how, again, there's all these other like intellectual connections and artistic connections that are happening in the world that is not just, you know, again, like US and Europe are the center, and then we, the rest of the world, are just like echoes of them. But in the real world, in the day-to-day lives of the artists, all these kind of like connections are happening all the time. Mm. And again, in the historizations, the conceptualizations that get forgotten. And I think, yeah, the fact that Ngudi talks so much about Gutai was really cool, as just like placing, again, like that she's not only, you know, she's not just thinking, although she talks about like Yvonne Rainer, for example, or American artists, that she's not only placing herself in relation to that structure, but you have like a Black woman artist, you know, naming Japan a decade early as one of her like lineages of work, as the people that she's looking at, that she's not looking at minimalism, she's looking at Gutai. There's something really cool about it.
But also, I mean, sorry, maybe this is kind of folded into what you're saying anyway, but like, you know, I'm just looking at the Tate definition of Gutai, and it says, their radical ideas and approaches to making art anticipated later performance and conceptual art of the 60s and 70s. And that does this weird thing of like, just saying like, oh, you know, like, and later when people just magically made this work, like we now look back at Gutai and think, oh, it anticipated it. And it's like, no, that's not it. Like artists who made that work found out about Gutai and were like, oh, this is amazing. And that informed their practice. So as you say, it's this very particular thing of like an artist, how an artist, yeah, gets energy and starts making new work or something.
And the other thing I was going to say is that although Ngudi went to Japan, she actually heard about, she saw Gutai before. So there's like this famous catalog of Gutai's art that was published in the US in the 60s, I think. And then Lydia Clark as well. Like, she saw a catalog in the 60s of the work. And then it made me think again, because this is for students. It's like, see, this is how you see work. You have to go to the library. You have to go to the gallery. You have to go to places to encounter work. And sometimes you don't encounter the real work. You know, sometimes you see it in the internet, or sometimes you see it randomly in a book, but you have to make space for those encounters to happen. They just, you know, they're not just going to find you. And you don't know, like, maybe you're looking at art and thinking, oh my God, that was me in art school, having massive crisis all the time, going like, oh my God, art is so boring. Artists are so boring. because the things that you're receiving at uni, you know, there's like so many students, there's only so many tutors, we all have our influences. Maybe the things that we're showing to you are really, you know, boring, or they don't talk about things in a way that makes sense to you. But then there's the whole universe and the whole history of the world of people making art. And your people are all there, but you need to find them.
Well, this is, again, like this notion of energy, right? Like, if I'm looking through a big book of loads of, I don't know, like something, an overview of a movement or a big catalogue of, you know, a huge group show or something, I flick through and I like take photos of the stuff that I like. But then that's the energy bit where you're like, oh yeah, that's cool, that's cool. But the work bit is like going back to those photos and like writing down the names, and then, you know, then looking up their work individually and going back to the library. You know, so like, again, it's about energy, initial excitement or interest, and then practice, which is like going back and doing the boring thing. And if you can ritualize that, then that's like how you do it, right? Like you take that energy, and you know that the next time you look back at that work, you're not going to be energized by it, but that's okay. You're just going to do the work anyway. And that's going to help you kind of, you know, bring those artists into your world or something.
Exactly.
Hello, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Andrea Franchi. Thanks, Andrea, for joining me again. Thanks to you for listening, and I hope you can join us for the next one, which will be on Robert Smithson and entropy.